Stan Evans hardly needs an introduction to this group. Former editor of the Indianapolis News, syndicated columnist, author of numerous books on American conservatism, trustee of the Philadelphia Society, he is going to tell us, I presume, why it should be, it should be, it should be that way.
Thank you very much. Before getting into my remarks, I, coming down this morning, heard a news bulletin on the radio. I'm not sure that all of you have heard it, so I thought I would pass it along. It has been announced that because of his rather vicious racial and ethnic slurs on certain groups, Billy Carter has been forced to resign his position as the president's brother. Professor Tonser has approached our subject with his usual lucidity and eloquence. His basic argument, as I understand it, is that the conservative movement can prosper only to the degree that it is grounded on consensus, fundamental considerations of right, and solid scholarship. No coherent worldview can be maintained, he suggests, and no long-term successes are possible if we disperse our energies in daily politics or confine ourselves to libertarian homily. All of this I take to be incontestably true and would therefore agree with the essential thrust of his position. My disagreement, such as it is of the yes but variety. I would affirm the central argument, but would give some of the particulars a different sort of emphasis. Let me focus on the more salient of these. First, his point about political involvement. Party politics should not and cannot be our major object. If we should lose ourselves in the ephemera of politics, we would be lost indeed, without compass bearings or moorings. At a recent ISI seminar, I tried to argue the point myself in somewhat less scholarly accents, suggesting that the ends of politics cannot be politically derived. They must come from a realm of affirmation beyond the legislature and the precinct. Yet, it has to be remembered that if we are concerned with the right ordering of our society, with protecting human freedom, combating social entropy, defending our national sovereignty, and so on, someone somewhere is going to have to do the political work, electing candidates, drafting legislation, seeing to the administration of the laws, and so forth. At some point, the insights of the scholar must be translated into the practical functions of the lawmaker. It may be plausibly argued that we have attempted such translation prematurely, or that some among us who should be spending more time on scholarly pursuits are dabbling far too much in party politics. But the fact remains that conservatives eventually must grapple with the stuff of politics in the colloquial meaning of that term. The particular twist I would give to Professor Tonser's point is this, that when conservatives become involved in politics, they must do so in terms of firm adherence to conservative value. All politics, as we well know, consists of compromise. But the key to a successful politics is to make the other fellow move in your direction. I think we have tended to forget this in recent essays at pragmatism by some among us. Some conservatives, in pursuit of a misguided pragmatism, have told us something rather different. They have told us that we must move in the other fellow's direction, but at a pace less rapid than he initially demanded. And that is a certain formula for defeat. Such confusions result, I think, from the sort of political immersion to which Professor Tonser refers. From an amateurish realpolitik that disparages resort to principle in an imagined effort to be practical. That approach is ruinous politically as well as intellectually, since it permits the opposition to define the terms of the discourse, and thus defaults the argument at the outset. Which leads me to the second point that I have noted in Professor Tonser's remarks, his point about libertarianism, and it has to do with the question of defining the terms of political discourse. It is perfectly true that libertarianism as such cannot define the terms of politics or set the axioms of the good society. Libertarianism, properly speaking, is not a premise but a conclusion. It is, indeed, the conclusion one arrives at if certain value postulates of Western faith and learning are accepted. And it is quickly forgotten if those value postulates are abandoned. This means, among other things, that ethical notions of right and obligation are primary, while elaborations of the market order are derivative. Where there is no community or sense of value, where there are no certain axioms of right, there can be no volitional order and no libertarian politics. The history of the 20th century affirms this truth abundantly. Yet it doesn't follow from this that our emphasis on personal freedom is passé or maybe relaxed. We suffer from disorders in our society, it is true, but these disorders are a violation of proper libertarian precept and not a vindication of it. And on almost every other front, meantime, we see that personal freedom is sorely threatened by the forces of compulsion from within and from without, and that our national affairs are managed with a stunning disregard for economic principle. I would venture to suggest that many, if not most, of the communal problems cited by Daniel Bell, health care, environmental problems, municipal finance, education, even crime to some extent, result from a failure by our rulers to understand the central precepts of economic science. Granted, the deeper moral sources of many of our problems, most of these communal difficulties in a practical sense may best be remedied by practicing libertarian economics rather than abandoning it. The third point that I have noted in Professor Tonser's excellent presentation is his point about new allies or potential new allies. Professor Tonser speculates about two possible new alliances for conservatives, one practical, the other intellectual. The first is the hard hat populist element so much discussed in recent political theorizing. The second is the group of predominantly Jewish intellectuals associated with commentary and the public interest. He sees little hope of getting together with the first, but considerable promise of alliance with the second. I view these cases somewhat differently, and granted the obvious distinctions between them, would apply a common rule to both. I think an alliance de facto is possible with each of these groups, capable of evolving across the years into something stable and enduring, provided that conservatives in search of such alliance stick by their own principles. In the case of the populist hard hats, the fallacy of some recent theories is the notion that we must jettison our defense of limited government and personal freedom to advocate a kind of welfare state for blue-collar ethnics, recircuiting dollars from liberal client groups to our own. I think this is mistaken in terms of principle and in terms of practical politics as well. It's clear enough that working class Americans are moving toward conservatism these days, and they're doing so precisely because they feel the costs of the liberal welfare state in terms of crime and taxes and busing and the rest of it, have become excessive. It is precisely because conservatives have articulated that notion all along that conservatives now have some hope of appealing to these voters. Such potential supporters should, of course, be addressed in recognizable accents with stress on issues that concern them most. But they should not be assailed with a pragmatic mishmash of Tory welfarism, cum law and order, that blends insensibly into the very liberalism they are beginning to oppose. In a radically different context, the identical principle applies to the one-time liberal intellectuals who have been drifting so perceptibly toward conservatism in recent years. I, for one, welcome this development and believe we should encourage it in every way we can. Some of the research and social analysis that appears in commentary in the public interest is amazingly good, and as credentialed liberals, these writers can reach an audience that is denied to most of us. Yet let us understand what is in process here. These intellectuals are moving quite clearly toward our position. We are not, with a few exceptions, moving toward theirs. Their insights have become increasingly profound and increasingly accurate, almost exactly in the proportion that they have come to approximate our own. Whether the subject up for discussion is the Cold War, internal security, the economics of healthcare, or the follies of mass transit. And just to pick a few examples from people who are members of this society, I would match the scholarship and the social commentary of a Russell Kirk, a Gerhard Niemeyer, a Stefan Pessoni, or a Steve Tonser against anything that the liberal intellectuals could put up. George Nash made a very relevant comment about the two books on crime by James Q. Wilson and Ernest Vandenhagen. I think everyone who has read those books will acknowledge that the Wilson book is very good, but the Vandenhagen book is better. I would sum it up in a symbolic formula that I have cast as follows. Crystal is great, but Friedman is greater. Let us, therefore, be of good cheer. The concerns that Professor Tonser articulates are very real. The potential pitfalls are many. Yet, as both preceding speakers have indicated, the signs of a second spring do exist, and the vernal impulse may be sensed in many different byways of our national life. What is needed for the ultimate victory is to understand our principles and to act on them. Thank you.